Mars Season on BBC Radio 4.
As we dream of sending humans to Mars, the psychological problems of a mission loom large. Here, Claudia Hammond investigates the mindset of those who want to colonise the Red Planet.
Boy, it's so far away. It's a world with its own moons. It's got water. I mean, who would not want to be among the first to go there?
I think it's going to be one of those adventures that will change you forever. Oh, yeah, I'd like to go.
Can you imagine being the person who was there, the person who looked at a rock and thought, oh, I wonder what's underneath it, and turned it over and found evidence of past or even present life on Mars? That would be absolutely incredible.
If by the time I am 60 or 80 or so on Mars, I can look back and then see that the groundwork that I helped to lay is leading to something beautiful and new. In many ways, the first society on another world. Then I will definitely be able to look back and smile and know that my life really had meaning.
For many, the Red Planet is special. It's come to symbolise something more than space exploration, the ultimate challenge, new hope for the future of humanity even. Our dreams of finding life there might have shrunk from encountering a Martian race to finding microscopic life forms. Our thoughts of colonisation might have been tempered by the reality of high radiation levels and the dangers of the 2.5 year round trip. Yet we would still go, or some of us would. A new poll for BBC Radio 4 revealed that 24% of people would venture on a return trip to Mars. I have to confess that I'm not among them. Since I get sick just sitting in the back of a car, I'm not sure I'm the right person to go in a spaceship. Then to be isolated so far away, with the Earth just a distant speck, and the knowledge that rescue is remote, terrifies me. But I am fascinated by the psychology of why this is a real dream for so many. Why is there this drive to go? First, there's the journey to get through, probably with just 5 other people, in a spacecraft much smaller than they had in the film Martian. And it's the effects of this journey on an astronaut's mind that is worrying the professionals.
A Mars mission is going to be different than anything that we've done before. Since the human is front and center, we're not going to be doing this robotics. We've already done that. We've put robots on Mars. We've put vehicles and remote-controlled systems. And now it's time to send the humans. And when, if we're going to put the humans into the picture, then we need to worry about how they're going to play their role in the outcome.
Each astronaut needs to cope with fear, anxiety, loneliness, and of course being stuck with each other on the 2.5 year round trip. It's the ideal recipe for conflict. Professor Cheryl Bishop from the University of Texas specialises in the psychology of space, advising on a growing number of Martian simulations here on Earth. She says research-wise we've got a lot to learn. In our known universe, it's the human reaction that remains unknown.
Since we've never had a long-duration mission, there is a great deal of concern that we don't have all the pieces necessary to do as good a job as what we would like to do in order to select for long duration. And that's why there's such a high activity right now and high focus on looking at analog environments to try to, again, flush out those factors that might be really critical. You don't know what you don't know. And it's very difficult to understand what you don't know if you don't have an actual environment in which to go ahead and test out some of these ideas that we have about what would be the best fit person for a long-duration mission.
My name is Samuel Paler. I'm the crew scientist for High Seas Mission 5. Today is Sol 30, which puts us about 7 months away from the end of the mission. So today has mostly been filled with EVA activities, which stands for extravehicular activity. So that's where we leave the habitat in spacesuits and go and explore the surrounding lava plains on the side of the volcano.
Could this be Mars? Well, not quite. Wannabe traveller Sam and crew of 5 are holed up in a remote part of Hawaii, experiencing many of the arduous conditions that anyone on a mission to Mars will have to endure.
It's remarkable, really, how adaptable humans are. This is a fairly extreme environment in the sense that it's confined, it's isolated, And the adaptation for me has been fine. I haven't felt lonely once since I've been here, despite the isolation. More the problem is actually finding personal time and personal space for yourself. And that's something that crews going to Mars are really going to have to learn to deal with, essentially having almost no personal time and personal space. And we're getting on very well as a unit, and hopefully that continues for the rest of the mission.
So, Sam, do you think you have what it takes mentally to survive the next few months? Ah, no answer yet. To add to the realism of the simulation, there's a signal delay, just like there will be on Mars. Even once Sam has heard my question and answered it, I won't hear that response for another 20 minutes. So we'll just have to wait. Back to Earth, then. Why would anyone want to do this? Alex Kumar would love to go. He's an expedition doctor who's visited all sorts of remote parts of the globe, armed with a stethoscope and his curiosity.
What took me down to the Antarctic winter for 11 months of madness? You know, it's something inside you. I spoke to Rand Fines once, Sir Ranulph Fines, and asked him, why does he do what he does? You know, and Prince Charles described him as being mad but marvellous. And I'd say the same, but there's something inside him. It's like a Duracell battery or something that just won't stop. And it won't stop because something else is out there. There's a mountain to climb. There's a record to beat. There's something to attain. And, it, you know, it's not all about titles, but he doesn't stop. It took him three times to summit Everest. And in the same way, it'll take us failed times to get to Mars.
Our love affair with a mission to Mars seems to have reached peak enthusiasm. Ryan MacDonald, a young astrophysicist at Cambridge University, is one of 100 people from around the world who've been shortlisted from more than 200,000 candidates to join Mars One. The idea is not just to land on Mars, but to start a human settlement there. It's a controversial and dramatic departure from more conservative explorations, not least because the mission's design involves many technical uncertainties and the plan is to part fund it via a reality TV show. But for the moment, Ryan is happy to be part of it. The odds of actually going might be long, but for him, doing something, even if it's only supporting the idea of living on Mars, far outweighs doing nothing.
I particularly remember seeing photographs that were taken from the surface of Mars by the Viking landers in the 1970s. And that really triggered something in me, because when you see photographs taken from the surface of an alien world that don't look that dissimilar from somewhere you might imagine, say, like in the Atacama, for instance, here on the Earth, but it's a place where no one has gone before, but you could imagine standing on that plane yourself and gazing out over the horizon. That's when it really seemed real to me that, hey, I could be one of those people that goes there in the future. And so for me, when you're doing a PhD, and in the very first year, you find something that no one else has ever found about the universe before. And for a brief moment, you know something that no human's ever known before. That, for me, is the real epitome of where you get if you follow curiosity. And so imagining myself standing on Mars as a scientist and searching for signs of life there, that was a very vivid image for me when I was growing up, and it still persists to this day.
And how much do you want to go to Mars?
How can you quantify something like that?
Any way you like.
Well, I could define natural units where one equals infinity. Or if we don't keep asking new questions and pushing the unknown frontiers, we'll stagnate as a species. So for me personally, I can think of very little more important than going to Mars.
So why does Mars in particular pique our curiosity? Psychologists have found that we're most curious when we know something about a subject, enough to get us wondering, but not too much. Rather like the first explorers to sail to the Americas, it's the known unknown, the gap in our knowledge. It's called the information gap theory of curiosity and dates from the early 1990s. The man behind it is Professor George Loewenstein of Carnegie Mellon University. The gap, he says, feels like a mental itch, a mosquito bite on our mind, and the only way to scratch that itch is to seek out new knowledge.
We tend to be curious about things when we feel like we're close to getting the answer, like kind of the tip of the tongue phenomenon. And with all these probes being sent to Mars, we're getting some kind of tantalizing clues. And that's kind of the ideal incubator for curiosity.
This whole idea of the information gap, what is the perfect gap like?
Well, the perfect gap is where you know a lot, but there's still a well-defined, unanswered question. In the case of Mars, there's a lot of questions, but certainly the number one question is whether there's life there or has been life on Mars in the past. It's a very kind of salient information gap for a lot of people.
When it comes to curiosity, what's special about these medium-sized gaps as compared with a small information gap or a large information gap?
Well, people tend to be most curious when they know a lot about a topic, but there's some kind of salient question that remains unanswered. That's sort of the sweet spot for curiosity. If you don't know very much about something, you don't tend to be curious about it. And of course, if you've answered the question, you're no longer curious because you have the answer.
So I guess in a way, Mars is similar enough to Earth for us to be able to picture having some kind of settlement there and to kind of imagine a bit what that might be like, because we know enough for that.
Oh, that's right. The more you can fill in the gap with hypotheticals, that also tends to create a lot of curiosity. It can lead people to do all sorts of things that are against their self-interest. It's a very, very powerful drive.
And with Mars One, it needs to be. The proposed trip is one way, which of course raises huge ethical and moral questions if people are to live out the rest of their lives on Mars. But in our poll, 12% of people said even if a trip was one way, they would still like to go. Now, of course, it's much easier to answer a hypothetical question in a poll than to actually do it. But Ryan has thought it through, and he regards the huge risks to be worth the gamble for the chance to walk on the red planet.
Let's say I went to Mars, and then I returned. Then we can look at the case study of Neil Armstrong, for instance, who spent the rest of his life trying to effectively just avoid the attention that garnered. His life was, for many intents and purposes, over by the time he actually returned from the moon. I want to be the hands, eyes and ears of the entire scientific community on Mars. And I want to record videos speaking to school children here on the Earth, for instance. I can do so much more by staying on Mars to achieve what I value in life, which is promoting science education and then searching for life elsewhere in the universe. I wouldn't be able to do that if I was just being paraded around the Earth as one of the first people to go to Mars.
Beautiful, beautiful. Isn't that something?
When it comes to how people would actually cope psychologically with a trip to Mars, those lunar missions might seem like the obvious place to start.
That's a good step, yeah.
But they were brief, with small crews of fighter pilots, often drawn from a single country. But long-term space travel needs different skills and sensibilities from the right stuff of the early space explorers. The astronaut Mike Barrett has been on several medium-term missions on the International Space Station, that giant science lab in near-Earth orbit. Some of the conditions there are similar to those that astronauts bound for Mars will experience.
I can tell you that on day 199, I didn't want to come home. And I was thinking, you know, I could take this crew, we could break orbit and we could go to Mars.
I know in your work you've looked a lot at the physiological changes that happen in space. Would
sure.
some of those affect people's mindset and affect how they cope?
Absolutely. You know, when you think about the stresses of spaceflight, you're in zero gravity and your body starts undergoing a lot of changes. And some of them are very unpleasant, like space motion sickness, the head stuffiness we get. You start losing fitness. You know that you're losing bone mass and muscle mass. So sure, it is one more contributor to the psychological surround, as I like to call it, of a flyer, especially early into their flight.
So how much harder do you think it would be coping psychologically with going to Mars?
I think significantly harder. Detachment from Earth, no real-time communication, much more limited supplies, much more cramped space. And I think all of us understand that as we kind of look at the things that sustain us up there and think about taking those away. That's counterbalanced by the fact that you are going to a new world. And if you're the first or among the first, you're representing the human race in something really quite amazing. And the excitement of the destination, I think, can sustain folks for quite a while.
And now that the intensely competitive space race has given way to international cooperation, it's getting more important for astronauts to communicate across cultural boundaries if fights, yes, actual fights, are to be avoided. Norbert Kraft, who's the chief medical officer of Mars One, spent 110 days in an isolation chamber in Moscow as commander of a small international crew of women and men, and it didn't all go well.
We were two groups, so one was a full Russian group and our group was an international one. But what happened is that, for example, the culture clashed with each other because they were not trained what the other culture expect, and so the two of the Russians, one of my group, one other group started a fist fight with bleeding noses, and after that we were good buddies again. However, the Japanese in our group was completely shocked. And tell you the extent of that is, every week we ask, what is your worst happening in your life? And they always said a car accident he had. But after this fist fight, it was the fist fight suddenly. So you see really the people becoming here the problem. The Japanese was so shocked, he left the isolation chamber after 60 days. He should have stayed 110. He said, I can't stand it anymore. I had to get out.
So if the people are going to be as much of a problem as the environment, how do you ensure that they really can depend on each other? Maybe it's just a matter of choosing the right people in the first place.
What we found out is that it's the mission that defines the kind of personality that's needed. Shuttle was different from people who are on International Space Station because there's two different kinds of roles and that require different kinds of personalities. We know something about the difference between a short duration and a modest duration near Earth orbit where you have lots of resources and instant communication, but we don't know very much about what's going to be the kind of person that does well in a true long duration away from Earth kind of mission.
What's your guess? What kind of personality would be best?
Well, I think we have a good idea about the kind of individual that would do well in the environment that would characterize a long-duration mission, monotony, tedium, boredom, restricted environmental stimuli. But, you know, a group is greater than the sum of the individuals. So you can select a great group of individuals that alone and by themselves have personalities that look like they would be a good fit. But then when you put them together, the dynamics between the individuals become highly critical factors that have to be put together. So there's a two-step process. One is we have to identify individuals that are good on their basis of their own. And then we have to put them together to see how they interact with other individuals and then pick the best group out of that kind of pool. So it's going to be a fairly long process to identify our ultimate crew to put on our first Mars mission.
3, 2, 1, come on!
A bleary-eyed crew are welcome back to Earth after a whole year cooped up in a research pod on the dusty lava plains of, well, not exactly the red planet, but Mauna Loa in Hawaii. Its volcanic slopes just happen to resemble the dry surface of Mars, making it the perfect place for a series of missions called High Seas, which are attempting to figure out how people can live together in situations similar to Mars, what works and what doesn't. Soil scientist Carmel Johnston was commander of this latest group of six to leave the experimental isolation unit.
It's a large white dome. It's about 110 square meters, and it's got two stories. It's got a lower floor with a kitchen and a dining room, a common room, bathroom, and a biology lab.
Sun-dried tomatoes in there.
And crystallized eggs.
And then the upstairs is all of our bedrooms and a small bathroom as well.
During the year, the crew spent quite a lot of time filling in questionnaires, more than 3,000 in all, monitoring their sleep, appetites, their mental health, and who they were and weren't getting on with. Let's hope all those stay confidential. They've been through every test of team building and stress you can think of. So what have we learnt? Kim Binstead, Principal Investigator of High Seas.
Well, one thing that we found is that there is no group that will not have conflict. What you can do instead is you can train a crew to be very resilient. So when there's a problem, they can respond to that problem in a way that's effective and resolve it quickly so that they return to a high-performing state. But also highly cohesive crews tend to be more autonomous. And that's not necessarily good news, especially for NASA, which likes to have a lot of control over missions. So a highly cohesive crew is going to be doing really well at whatever they do, but they might choose to do something different from what ground control wants them to do. So one of the things that we're interested in is how much of a problem is that? And if it isn't much of a problem, how can we change how NASA works with missions to have them be more comfortable with these high autonomy crews?
Oh, that must be Sam Paler, who's cooped up in a high seas mission right now. His reply to my question 20 minutes ago has reached me at last. I can't quite remember exactly what I was asking, but I'm sure it'll all make sense.
Communicating over delays to try and solve problems can be very stressful because we don't have internet here. So trying to
you know, Google something is actually really tricky. We have to go and get someone else to do it, and we have to wait 40 minutes before the answer comes back. So not being able to solve problems for yourself is really frustrating, and something that we have to get used to. Having said that, family and friends often ask me if the 7 months remaining seems like a long time, and it really doesn't. The days are flying by currently, so I'm not counting down the days at all. I'm just enjoying the mission, enjoying the moment.
But there is something that no simulation can ever predict. No one in human history has ever been so far from our home planet, which means no one knows the psychological effects of seeing the Earth almost disappear into the darkness of space. That view of our planet, which has sustained so many astronauts in the past, just won't be there. Astronaut Mike Barrett again.
At the very best, you'll be able to pick out Earth, if you know where it's supposed to be, as a pale blue dot somewhere way off in the distance. And for those zero-generation explorers who are from Earth, it's going to be a tremendous amount of detachment that we've never really seen the likes of before.
So that sounds very different from the overview effect, where people look back on Earth from space and you know, astronauts I've spoken to about that say they absolutely love that, and people seem to really get a huge amount of pleasure from looking back at the Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. This immense sense of beauty and solitude that was almost spiritual in a way. You know, I think astronauts probably get that on steroids just because of the breathtaking view we get of Earth and how amazing that is. Right now, when you look out the window of the International Space Station, the Earth is absolutely the dominant thing. And you leave that astern, if you will, and you transition to that point where you're working hard to recognize which is the Earth versus the other points of light out there. That adds a whole new dimension to a level of detachment. So sure, psychologically, that's going to be a huge challenge.
So you have this period of a big black hole, so to speak, in the middle, where they cannot look back on the blue planet and they haven't seen, oh my God, yeah, there's Mars, and now let's go. And that's really the time where they have to work with each other and support each other to overcome that period. I think that's the most difficult period. Because really then it sinks in, there is no return, you cannot turn around the rocket, you just go.
Norbert Kraft. The nearest we can get on Earth to the blackness of space is the endless night of the Antarctic winter. How does the mind cope with that? Beth Healy is a doctor who spent more than a year both experiencing for herself and studying for the European Space Agency the effects of life at Concordia in Antarctica. She and 12 others were cut off from the outside world with no means of escape for 9 months, just as astronauts bound for Mars would be.
I was nervous, probably before I even applied. And then when I actually got the sort of thumbs up, I did question sort of myself as to whether it was actually something I wanted to do. And I think that sort of didn't stop, even when I was there, really, because I actually arrived during the Antarctic summer. So I had several months where I could have sort of, you know, left the base if I'd really wanted to. So it wasn't until that last plane left after the summer that I really realised that I was in it for the long haul and I was actually going to be doing this.
And how close a simulation is Concordia to Mars?
Well, there's lots of different spaceflight analogues, and they're all really good at different things. But what's really great about Concordia is essentially it's a place where you can ethically isolate a crew. So we were completely isolated for 9 months of the year, which is it's really unique opportunity to be able to research. And so if we're to have a medical problem, it's just not possible to evacuate people. And that makes a big difference in terms of the medical models we use, but also the psychology and physiology on the crew as well.
Every year, another group overwinters. And 1 year, that included Dr. Alexander Kumar.
You learn more about yourself and about other people than probably I have in a whole lifetime in medicine, you know, in that sense. I'm not young in my career anymore in medicine, but in the Antarctic winter, you look deep within yourself. Chris Johnson, a consultant anaesthetist who wintered at Halley, the British Antarctic base in the 70s, told me you'll find things out about yourself that you may not necessarily like. And certainly at 3 o'clock in the morning, staring at the wall in 3 months of darkness, you know, you go deep within, but, you know, you come out and the sense of humour keeps you buoyant through those difficult times. There were people who malfunctioned psychologically, and it's difficult as a researcher to say when you stop researching and when you start treating as a doctor. But yeah, there was friction, there were hard times, but we all got through, everyone was standing and everyone survived.
Generally, the biggest challenge was the sleep-wake cycles. And as a crew, like, we have to react to that, of course. And one way that we did that was we made lunch and dinner times compulsory for all crew members. And this really was to keep us all together as a crew so that we didn't shift too much in one direction or the other, because obviously with a crew of 13, it's really important to maintain communications and have that time together as a social group to sort of look out for each other. What you do have to remember is that you're actually incredibly tired, like your cognition goes down a lot, and that was another thing that we were studying, actually. And so as a scientist working on the base, you know, I really did make the most of times where I felt at my most alert, and so I'd often sort of work through the night if I felt good, and then on perhaps another day I wouldn't work so much if I felt really tired, and that's kind of how it worked.
It's clear that the number of known unknowns is going up. But while the physical challenges of a mission to Mars are pretty well understood now, either you're protected from radiation or you're not, either there's a means of mending a broken leg or there isn't, when it comes to the mind, we're not really going to know how people will cope until we try it. Kim Binstead.
I think we're going to be able to choose people who are able to do well on these missions. I'm confident that we'll be able to do that. But the risk is significant. You know, if there is a conflict that affects crew performance, you know, if the human element of a mission goes wrong, it's just as hazardous as if a rocket blows up. You know, all of the elements need to work well together. You know, have we chosen the right crew? Well, we won't know that for sure until we send them.
It genuinely is the unknown, pushing not just our science to the limit, but also the human psyche to the limit.
Ryan McDonald again, who has, of course, already signed up for a one-way trip.
You have to push people to the breaking point to discover how their mind works. For instance, like, if I discover during selection or training for a mission to Mars that I don't have the right kind of mentality, that I'm not suitable, do not send me. The mission and the success of it is what matters. You only get one shot to have the first human mission to Mars, and if something goes terribly wrong with the first mission, that might deter future missions. So it's more important to me that the right people go than necessarily I go myself if I'm not one of those right people.
I'm still not sure I'd be up for the ride even if I could come back. Although having talked to 10 people who do want to go, I can't help but pick up on some of their enthusiasm. It would be amazing to venture somewhere that no one had ever been to before, to visit a completely new world, to fill in that enduring curiosity gap. And I can't wait to watch someone else do it.
We're happiest when we're learning or discovering new things. But then you're still left with the idea that it's a long way away. It's a very hostile place. It makes Antarctica look like a paradise, and it's not like we have people flocking to Antarctica to live there because it's such a great place. So those basic motivations of exploration and expanding the human species, if you will, have to be at the core of moving out there. But I also think that the possibility of finding life on another world than our own is very exciting. I can't think of any single discovery that we can make that would have more of a uniting influence on our planet than finding that we're not alone.
Greetings, this is William Shatner. I'm assisting BBC Radio 4 in their studies of the planet Mars.
When there's only 38% of Earth's gravity, can humans be born there?
The outer limits of science fact and fiction.
They're taking everything from us. All our trees are dying.
Don't be alarmed.
What are you going to do about the radiation?
If we stay strong, we can get through this together.
Mars is a long place to go to live underground.
An invasion of programs across BBC Radio 4. Journey to the BBC Radio 4 website for details.